You don't have control over what's inside you, but like you have control over what you
You
do.
have control over who's inside you.
That, yes.
Sorry.
That was way better. God, I love that. I think you should say that whole sentence like that.
Okay. You don't have control over what's inside you, but you do have control over who's inside you.
Welcome to More Than Tracy Turnblad, a podcast about fat representation in entertainment and media. I'm Luce, he, they.
I'm Abby, she, her. And we are two 20-something plus-size creatives trying to find our place in the industry and the world. And we just mixed up the intro for you there, so...
Just to give you a little taste, you know?
Did you catch? Yeah, so before we get into the main meat of the episode, which is the second part of our fat trope deep dive, where we're talking about the sad fat trope, we just wanted to give you a little bit of updates, talk about what's going on in the internet and the world of fat people this week, since we are actually recording this episode not way in advance for once.
Yep.
So what's going on with you, Luz?
So I am actually going to be heading back to Kansas, where I'm from, in about a week, a little less than a week now. That's crazy. For top surgery, which is really, really, really exciting. I am thrilled that this is happening, and it's been sort of a long time coming. I've been trying to figure it out for a while. And this is going to be, I think, a huge help in my, like, you know, gender dysphoria journey, and also just to make myself feel a little more comfortable day to day. And I'm hopefully going to be documenting some of it, at least from like pre-op to some post-op, just because I have not been able to see all that many people online with like my body type sharing their top surgery journeys. So I kind of want to be able to be that for other folks who look like me, just, you know, so that we have an idea of like what results can look like and like what, you know, different things you got to do for recovery purposes. But I'm so excited, and I'm hopeful that I get to share that with people. And yeah,
amazing.
I want you to share your little hair update with everyone.
Oh yes, I got a haircut, and it was 19 pounds is the gag, and I'm really proud of myself because I feel like I never know how to tell the hairstylist what I want, and it always ends up looking kind of weird. But I feel like I was able to be like, no, I need more shaping here, I need more light. Like, I was able to like actually communicate what I wanted, and I feel like I was able to get a decent haircut for 19 pounds, which is amazing.
Oh yeah.
Actually, my bigger news is that I'm in LA right now for the week.
Happy LA.
Thank you. It's been actually wonderful. I kind of don't want to go back. I'm just spoiled by the sun. But and I wasn't unhappy when I was in Brighton, but now I'm like, oh, I don't want to go back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I think just like spending too much time alone is not good for me. I'm spending so much time alone at school. So yeah. Now just like even just having Maxwell like in the next room is like better.
I totally get that. Just knowing that there are other people in your space can be helpful sometimes.
Right. It's been really nice. I got a surprise really cheap flight here. I can't remember if we talked about this last week. We probably did.
I think so. Yes.
But yeah. Cannot believe it. But here I am. 2 weeks ago I was in Portugal, so I'm like traveling like crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. And anyway, just that I'm really happy here. I'm coming to you live from Maxwell's closet, wearing a full face of makeup all from eyeshadow palettes. Minus
incredible.
The foundation. Because I left my makeup in the car. And I was like, oh, no, we're recording video, so I have to get my shit together.
Right, so, just a little bit. I have to serve face just a little bit. And then there's me who woke up like 20 minutes ago and like zhuzhed my hair a little bit and was like, this is fine.
And that is gender privilege.
It is.
No, I could have obviously come on without makeup. I just, if I'm going to be staring at my face for an hour.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
But I'm pretty proud of what I did with an eyeshadow palette. Although I put this like eyeshadow under my eyes and now I feel like I look really tired, but I'm actually not. I actually feel fine.
I kind of like it.
This is a story about how I don't have my shit together, but I woke up at 6 in the morning to get in this closet and do a voiceover audition that was due at 11 Eastern, which I just somehow missed until like yesterday night when I was getting into bed. And I was like, oh, fuck, my agent emailed me like hours ago. And it's a rush audition in by 11 a.m. Eastern, which means 8 a.m. L.A.
Damn.
So, yeah, there is truly about half of being a voice actor is building blanket forts.
That's kind of beautiful. Healing your inner child.
I'm like really good at it now. Do you know my secret life hack is that you use a suitcase and you use the top part as the table. Literally my mic is standing on a suitcase right now. And then you drape a blanket over the handle that's like fully extended.
Oh, wow. Mm.
And then if you have two or three suitcases, you can, that's all you need.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And a chip clip helps as well. I had some of those were also a part of this, but.
Chip clips are the best, undoubtedly.
For sure. So before we get into the sad fat trope, I want to talk about just like the week in fat representation, what's been going on. So I want to just make you all aware of this really exciting and amazing thing that happened, which is that Tess Holliday was consulting with Pinterest, and they have now launched a tool where you can sort based on body type, or you can filter like your results, and the representation in the body types that they have is amazing. There are like multiple people who have my shape, which is so rare, because you know, even when someone like allows a fat person in there, it's always like the hourglass person and like the fat shape is like curvy, but yes, this is like so diverse and it's amazing. And Tess has been doing, I can say Tess now because we're mutuals on TikTok. but she's been doing like consulting with a lot of brands, which is really cool. And if you're a brand who needs a consultant, you should hire her. Or if you can't afford her, you should hire me.
Work.
So yeah, that's just like a really amazing thing. I feel like it's really necessary progress that like we just fucking needed a win right now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We needed a win. And it's not, I feel like with TV, there's been some good stuff coming out, but like it's all stuff that was greenlit years ago. So right. I still remain worried about the future of like fat representation on TV.
Me
but
too.
This is like something that's happening now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really validating to know that like people out there are still talking about this and fighting for better representation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so great. I didn't know about that until we just got together a few minutes ago. And that's thrilling. Cause I remember, I mean, being on Pinterest and looking for certain things and being like, okay, like that's great. But like, this does not help me really at all.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's okay. It's so annoying when it's like all the fashion inspo is just stuff that doesn't even come in your size.
Right.
So that's really great. The other thing I wanted to just briefly touch on is like, I feel like the internet is aflame about Love is Blind right now and has been for the past few weeks, really. And this whole thing with the girl who said, people tell me I look like Megan Fox, but I think it's just because I have brown hair and blue eyes. And then the guy was like visibly disappointed when they met. And everyone's like, she lied. And it's like, she never said I look like Megan Fox. I'm sorry. Yep. I just can't get over that. And people are like so desperate to assign this catfish narrative to her.
Yeah.
And I just feel like there's a lot there about Love is Blind where when it's like she is probably the most curvy one on that season. Like she's more pear-shaped than any of the other girls, I think, this season. And it feels really weird that like, it's one of those things where, you know, fatness is contextual, right? And
yes,
putting her next to the real Megan Fox, yeah, she's fatter. So it's like people are treating that like she's this like evil catfish who's trying to trick him when she literally was like, people tell me this, but I don't think so.
That's fucking crazy. People like cannot give women a break. Like, I swear to God, she didn't even agree with it. She didn't even agree. Like, she just said that.
Love is Blind is a toxic cesspool, and I have just started watching it way late, but, you know, already you can see, like, they just pick the most fucking boring people in the world. I'm sorry.
Very true. I watched the first season, and I have not watched anything else, so.
I watched seasons 2, where they advertised that they would have fat people, and season 3, where they actually did have one fat person, and it was never mentioned. but then they stopped having fat people, so I stopped caring. But I did start watching this one after hearing all the drama, because I feel like it's really interesting how Love is Blind, and I've talked about this on this podcast before, loves to take issues that are like really fat issues and like issues of people who are actually like in marginalized groups who are not conventionally attractive. Like, I feel like disabled people also experience all of this, and assign them to like conventionally attractive white women. Not all white, but all conventionally attractive and heavily white. And then like act like they're experiencing the same thing. And it's really fucking weird, because it's like they want to address these things, but they refuse to actually address them. And this is just like yet another example about it. And we will talk more about the catfish trope as we go along with this episode, because what could be sadder?
Yeah, true. Devastating, really.
Truly. And on that note, let's get into the sad fat person.
Mm-hmm. Let's go.
So I think the sad fat person is like pretty ubiquitous, not quite as much as the comic fat person, but still very, very common. And I feel like this also does end up manifesting in real life, where people sort of assume the lives of fat people are sad, either because of what they've seen in media or because of a projection of their own fears. So I feel like a lot of times people make out low self-esteem to be like the saddest thing ever, when it's like a lot of thin people have low self-esteem too. And it's not that it's not sad to live thinking you're like a worthless piece of shit. Obviously it is. But I just feel like that gets assigned to fat people so quickly. And like sometimes the way it manifests for me is like, I can't talk about the hardships of being fat without people accusing me of hating myself. And it's like, no, but I don't hate me, but everyone else does. You know?
Yes.
And there was even a study that showed that people judged sad faces as more fat. So it like goes both ways. They're so intimately associated.
Okay. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Wow. So they like showed people a bunch of these faces and they judged the sad faces as fatter.
Wow.
Yeah. But only the men. So there's a lot of confounding variables. But anyway, yeah, that is a real study that we will link in the show notes.
Damn.
So I want to know, what is your relationship with the sad trope? Are you sad?
Weirdly, like, I'm not now. But I feel like I was a sad, thin person for a really long time. I kind of thought of depression and like sadness as like a fundamental part of who I am. But like most of that happened while I was thin, which is really interesting to me. I mean, it was also like when my eating disorder was at its height, and, you know, there's a lot of stress, sort of just existential stress about my body size and maintaining it and all of that.
Right.
So that obviously contributed. But it's really interesting because this is also like sort of a trans thing as well. But my family never expressed concern for me during those times of my life when I was actually like going the fuck through it.
Yeah.
However, recently I have had family members expressing concern to me and asking if I'm okay. I assume because of the noticeable transition that I'm making. And I'm like, that's odd. Like, I get it. I get that like physical things are changing about me, so it's more noticeable.
Right.
However, like, I'm actually like happy and contented for the first time in my life.
Yeah.
So it's actually really funny that you're concerned now and we're not concerned at any other point.
Exactly. It's like people just don't care about mental health, and they want to link physical body and mental health so linearly.
Yeah.
Like, they want it to be like the sadder you are, the fatter you are, and vice versa.
Yep. And like the more weird and fucked up looking you look.
Yeah. To their eyes. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, that's not normal. They can't possibly be happy looking like that when everyone is judging them. That's the subtext, I think.
Absolutely. Yes.
And so we get into, what is the sad fat trope? Like, why are these things so linked? And there are studies that actually have linked depression and higher body weights. Mm. So here's one article from The Guardian that put it in a really funny way. I don't know what I meant by funny, but you guys can take that how you will. Obesity and depression, a chicken and egg situation that baffles and beguiles medical health professionals and surgeries and academic journals equally. Which truly comes first in this Ouroboros of NHS resource drains? The incapacity to feel fully and interact with the world around you, or getting the 12-pack box of donuts instead of just the 3? Because screw it, I deserve some happiness today, don't I?
What the fuck?
We'll continue. That depression is more common in those who are overweight is known in medical circles, probably about as well as tired chicken and egg illusions are among regular folk who don't have the requisite level of smarts to take a Hippocratic oath. The first issue so often flows into the other and back the other way too, becoming all tangled up together in the everyday without us even noticing. So.
Jesus Christ.
This is peak British humor. I'm obsessed. It's actually, we're going to get to the rest of this article soon, but that is how it is essentially talked about. I think this is satirizing it a little bit, which will become clear when we talk a little bit more. But so basically the idea is like, oh my God, what could cause this association between depression and fatness? Maybe we should cure one and that'll cure the other. You know what I mean?
Yes.
What's your treatment for curing depression? Lose weight. What's your treatment for curing obesity? Stop being depressed.
Like, right.
That's where it goes in medical world, right?
Absolutely.
So there are a few different medical explanations. For example, people theorize that stress can cause both weight gain and depression. People hypothesize, of course, that being sad makes people eat, which makes them fat, which makes them sad, which makes them eat more, and so on.
That one is the one that I always think of when people are stereotyping, and I just fucking hate it. Anyway.
That's the 12-pack of donuts. Who's eating 12 donuts? I'm sorry.
Like,
you have binge eating disorder if you're eating 12 donuts. That's not something every fat person does. I'm sorry. I'm so done. I'm even mad at that wording in an article that I know is vaguely satirical.
Yep.
Anyway, there's also a possibility of genetics causing both fatness and sadness.
Not a possibility.
No way. No, there's one study. I mean, we know that both, like, body size and depression, mental health issues are, like, hereditary to some degree, at least. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, they studied being genetically predisposed to a higher BMI that was linked to depression. And the effect is stronger in women than men. Huh. I wonder why that could be.
That's interesting.
But here's the weird thing is that they studied separately the genes that cause higher BMI plus higher likelihood of health issues like diabetes and heart disease and stuff. And they also studied the link between higher BMI without any metabolic issues. And those people who were fat with no medical consequences, they were still depressed. What could this be?
That's crazy. I wonder what would be causing that.
So interesting. And then, of course, there's the obvious fact that antidepressants cause weight gain. And this Healthline list of hypotheses on obesity and depression FAQs put it in an interesting way. Many prescription antidepressants list weight gain as a common side effect. Likewise, some weight management therapies can lead to emotional ups and downs that can cause or worsen depression.
Mm-hmm.
A quote diet, end quote, has a lot of opportunities for failure or setbacks. This can challenge a person who's already dealing with mental health issues. Yeah. So,
well,
tell me something I don't know, healthline.com. But I really like that that's acknowledged. This article from The Guardian that we kicked off with then reports on the shocking new findings. And shout out to Phoebe Jane Boyd, who wrote this article. You're funny, girl. She was talking about how there was new research done by the University of Exeter and University of South Australia, a study of 48,000 people, which determined, gasp, the psychological impact of being obese is likely to cause depression. Yeah. So I'm going to read you some more quotes from this article because it's just too good. Judgment of the overweight makes overweight people depressed. It's a groundbreaking idea, isn't it? Get this, if you're a person with a healthy BMI and you're scoffing about feeling, quote, fat today, end quote, next to an overweight person who's now realizing you see them as lesser/objectionable, you're a public health hazard. You're the mental health equivalent of eating a box of donuts every day. You're poisoning the wellness of those around you. And I'm like, yas, queen.
Yes.
Then she goes on to Actually use an example from the entertainment industry. It's like, say you work in the entertainment industry, you're producing films where the plus size female lead has to sustain a head injury in order to feel confident enough to have a successful romantic life and to be loved. Yes. And those watching are invited to laugh at the ridiculousness of an overweight woman believing she's worthy of love. And then if you're involved in those films, you could possibly or even probably be contributing to an environment that negatively affects the mental health of your audience. Perhaps your film poster should contain a health warning. And then they go on to talk about like government funded campaigns to fight obesity and the ones that result in accusations of body shaming and also don't really work. I love this line. Is the impulse to help enough to justify the negative impact, the hum this all adds to the white noise of negativity overweight people are surrounded by already? So I basically just read that entire article out loud, but I just really liked that article. And I think it's...
I think it's incredible.
It's really funny and it's really snarky. And shout out to Phoebe Jane Boyd who wrote it.
We so rarely actually talk about that being a factor, like very rarely, which I find shocking. And because it seems like such a clear cause and effect, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, if everyone's telling you that you suck and you're ugly and you're horrible and you're undeserving of love, like, I don't think anyone would be like, I feel great. I'm actually really awesome and I feel super cool.
Right. It's like, maybe being socially ostracized and told your body is like not only unattractive, but also a moral failure and everyone's worst fear and a literal threat to society. Maybe that could like impact your mental health, maybe. But no, it's probably just the donuts. It's probably just the it's probably you were already genetically depressed and now you just eat donuts to cope.
Like, right, right.
Yeah.
Right. It's of just, course.
It boggles my mind that it's taken so long for people to like even hypothesize that could be the link. And it's just like, I feel like it's just kind of evidence that like fat people are never considered as people when people are looking at these things. It's like, I think part of it is like the insistence on like, there's a thin person inside of you, blah, 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 that kind of rhetoric. Like, so we don't even address fat people as having separate mental health problems than anybody else. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Because it's like you're just a thin person in a fat suit. Like,
Nobody thinks of being fat as like a sort of permanent state.
Right.
Of being like a natural state for a person to be in.
It's too sad. Like, oh my God. And it's just like, it's the thing where it's funny seeing this for like an audience of people who the majority of whom are overweight or obese BMI wise. This is a UK article, like 60% of the UK is overweight or obese, I think. It's just like, are the fat people in the room with us right now? Like, who is this for? Because reading fat people as like the third party over here, it's just always so confusing to me when it's like, no, literally most of your audience has their weight problematized by the medical system. Like the majority. So
absolutely.
It's just so weird. And I feel like there's also the obvious thing of like not wanting to address that perhaps the way that I treat fat people could be contributing to their worse mental health.
Yeah.
And the idea that like having your mental health cared about and addressed is like a privilege reserved for once you're like morally good enough to deserve that care.
Woof. Yeah,
there's so much here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so then, of course, like, I feel like for a lot of people, the leap becomes, okay, well, getting thinner will cure my depression. Because.
Yeah. And it doesn't.
No, at least, it does not.
At least not for me. You would think, I mean, there is a momentary sort of, I guess, relief when you don't have to experience the ostracization anymore.
Right.
However, it's a new sort of like mental battle begins at that point, which is like the terror of like ending up being ostracized again.
Yeah.
You know, and like that can get you into eating disorderville really, really quick. In terms of just desperately trying to to stay out of like harm's way, you know?
Yeah. And you know, there was actually a study in 2005 that showed that getting thinner does not improve mental health. And that's not necessarily correlated. And actually, interesting fact, the suicide rate then, at least then, if not also still now, was higher, like people who had committed suicide, their BMI was on average significantly lower than those who did not.
Interesting.
And one of the theories about this is just interesting, is that insulin resistance can like increase serotonin. So if people are fat because of insulin resistance, they might actually have more serotonin and be happier.
Interesting.
Isn't that weird?
That is odd, but I love that if that's true.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's fascinating. And then they're like, oh, people who eat more might also have higher levels of serotonin. They had some good interviews in this article too. And one said, very similar to what your experience was, being thin is not all it's cracked up to be. Getting there and staying that way can be a real mental drain for some. Dieting is about deprivation. It can make you more depressed than being obese.
This is definitely like my anecdotal experience. However, like it, for me, it's sort of like, it doesn't really matter what size I'm at. If I'm in that like headspace, then it all kind of sucks.
Being like so preoccupied with how my body looked on any given day was just not good for me. And it wasn't good for the people around me. Like, it made me kind of a miserable person to be around, too. And it, like, contributes to probably their feeling more negative when they're around me. Because it's just such a bummer to be around somebody who's, like, that obsessed with the way they look.
It is a downer. Yeah.
Yeah. I also think that, like, we should talk about the pressure on fat people to diet. Because for many of us, we can't enjoy food because we're so fixated on, like, is this good? Am I a good person for eating this? I shouldn't be having this, blah, blah, blah. So it's like when you think about what people want to think of as being a good life, it involves good food. Like it does. Mm. It involves high quality food. Eat, pray, love, right? We don't get eat because we can't. We don't get love because no one will love us, supposedly, right? So all that's left is pray and become a nun. That's it.
Become celibate.
That was my plan. Genuinely, I was like, I will lean into asceticism. I should have been a nun. It's such a curse that I'm Jewish. Like, I literally was like, I would be the best nun.
That's insane to hear, like, knowing you.
Knowing me now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. No, if you knew me from age maybe 12 through 20, I was like, I should have been a nun.
Wow.
So.
Incredible.
Let's talk about how this is depicted in media.
Yeah, let's get into it.
In the actual subject of our podcast.
Yeah, welcome, folks. We've arrived. This trope, I feel like, is so ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And it's not even necessarily a fat person. It can be just like, you know, a thin person, like crying on the scale or eating to deal with like strong emotions, typically like sad or a breakup.
Yes. Sometimes it feels like the tragedy of that in the audience's eyes is supposed to be that this person who's not fat is so afraid of being fat or so preoccupied about their weight. It's the weight woe trope.
Absolutely.
From TV tropes.
Yes. One that we wrote down is Fat Thor's depression leading to his weight gain, which I remember when I was watching that being so like shocked and horrified.
Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck? Please.
And Not Like Many is kind of a combo of like the sad fat trope, but then they still make fun of him like every chance they get. So
Yeah.
And people have zero sympathy for him, even though he's literally grieving.
Yeah.
Because it's manifested in fatness.
Yeah. And you know what? I wish he stayed fat. Anyway.
I do too. I'm glad they let him stay fat through the end of the movie though.
Yes. Correct.
That was good at least. They didn't have like the magical weight loss trope, which is another episode.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, we can't have this episode without mentioning the whale.
The whale is this trope.
Like the worst example of like the sad fat person. Like if you're thinking of trying to explain this to someone, that is the example to give.
Look
truly.
It up in the dictionary and it's a picture of Brendan Fraser's fat suit.
Dead.
Yeah, I think eating when sad is like a really common trope and it is a commonly accepted coping mechanism for thin people, which is funny.
Yep. Like ice cream, cookies, chocolates, etc.
Post breakup. Like
yes. In bed.
I wrote down a couple examples of like Aquamarine where she says, "Who needs Raymond? I found two new men to love. Their names are Ben and Jerry." I always felt so represented by that because I'm from Vermont. And then, of course, there's the Rory Gilmore wallowing. Ice cream is a quintessential part of the wallow. Mm-hmm. Like when Luke breaks up with Lorelai and she's in bed, Rory brings her like cookie dough. Like,
yes.
It's just like a very normal part of breakup grieving is eating a lot.
Yes.
Which is funny because you also have, of course, the post-breakup like glow up trope. But I guess you only have to eat a lot for like a couple days.
Right. There's a point where it becomes concerning, I suppose, to people.
And I think that point is getting fat.
Yeah, I do think that point is getting fat.
Yeah.
They're like, okay, like be thin, eat a lot for a couple days, and then go back to being normal.
And like in Legally Blonde, like Elle is eating chocolates and watching General Hospital, and her friends literally are like, sweetie, no. Like, stop doing this. You're going to get fat.
Interesting. Okay. Why don't you just sit there and watch General Hospital with her? Rude.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Martha Dunstock.
Ugh.
Terrible example of this.
Right.
Terrible.
This is like fat causing sad versus sad causing fat.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like Martha Dunstock is actually like a pretty like realistic example of like being socially ostracized and having that like affect everything about your life. However, I don't feel like that's the way that she's necessarily portrayed.
Right.
I feel like she's portrayed as like delusional.
Yeah. And she's like mocked throughout the whole thing.
Yes.
And I think she has to be delusional to experience that level of like being bullied. Do you know what I mean? Because like,
yeah.
I just feel like any fat person who's like lived in the world long enough probably would have observed. I mean, there might be exceptions, but like probably would have figured out that like having this naive hope is just going to get you publicly ridiculed. And
right.
That's my issue with Martha Dunstock is that she's like too stupid to get that like her like loudly asking the popular jock out is not going to go well.
Of course, because I feel like even with my like really early on experience with being like a fat kid contextually, I learned so quick to not tell anyone that I had feelings for anyone.
Yeah.
If I had any crushes, I was like, I'm not fucking telling anyone. What do you mean? Lips are sealed. I have no feelings.
Right. No, that same. I mean, I feel like it becomes really obvious when you see it in media all the time and maybe see it happen to other people around you. And most people have a self-preservation instinct that's going to kick in.
Right. Yeah, at a certain point.
Probably a lot of us are able to figure that out, if not through like intuitive social understanding, then through like observation. But that's not represented because they want to show how devastating and sad the bullying is.
Other examples, romantic tragedy. The tragedy being that this person is deserving of love, except they're fat.
Right. That's the tragedy, is the contrast of their inside and their outside. Which is why, like, people like Martha are presented as being so pure, beautiful cinnamon rolls kind of thing.
Yes.
And then it's like, how sad that she will never have the love she deserves.
Exactly. God. The inevitable death trope also applies.
Yep. And we're back at the whale.
And we have arrived.
So I pulled out this quote from the New Yorker's article about the whale from, like, I think it was just after the movie came out. And, it's an interesting case because it presents depression and fatness as both as like a cause and symptom of each other. So it's like, I mean, I guess it's more that the depression caused the fatness because he's like consciously eating himself to death. Right. So it's like his sad depression and the homophobia of the society, like that ostracization caused him to eat as a coping mechanism. And now he's eating to kill himself. And that's sad to us because he's so socially ostracized.
That's interesting that it does kind of. Ooh, it does kind of put homophobia in like a place where you can empathize with somebody experiencing homophobia, but not anti-fatness.
Yeah, no, it's like it's really interesting. And I think a lot of people do empathize with homophobia, but not anti-fatness.
Absolutely. Yes.
And it's like, but if the anti-fatness was a product of homophobia, that's sad enough for you to care, right?
Right.
So the quote was, in humanizing Charlie, quote unquote humanizing, by the way, Aronofsky seems to want to repel the viewer so that we can pat ourselves on the back for finding the man and the monster. But is that empathy or pity? And we're going to get to everything in this quote, like, summarizes the second half of this episode. But mm-hmm. just putting that in your head for now.
Yep. I don't even think it's empathy or pity. I think it's rude. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I think there needs to be, like, more of a recognition that, like, pity isn't always positive.
No, it's not. Absolutely yeah. not. It's sometimes very rude and unwarranted.
It's like infantilizing almost, you know?
Infantilizing, yes.
And it can absolutely. Be very smug as well, mm-hmm. which we will get to. Oh, another example of this is the literal personification of sad in Inside Out is Fat. Like, let's point that out. And yeah, she's a great character otherwise.
My it's God. Just like,
it's interesting.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, holy it's shit. Interesting. How they chose to make Sad fat and Joy thin. And there was this article in the Huffington Post by Joni Edelman who was really upset about it. And she wrote, children cannot simply discern things that are nuanced. They see the character sad, blue, fat, glasses on her chunky emo face. And guess what? That's sad. You literally just defined sad for my 4-year-old. Thanks a lot.
Work.
Yeah. So it's like in its purest form, sad is personified as a fat person.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. I mean, she's adorable, I will say. Sad is adorable. However,
a sympathetic fat person, because the sympathetic yes. ones are always adorable.
Yep. They have to be adorable. Boo. Okay, let's talk consequences of fat sadness.
Yeah, so like in dealing with the depression of social ostracization, what do characters mm-hmm. do to cope?
Oof, the catfish trope.
Yes.
We're circling back.
Yes, we are. And God. It's like even a fleeting amount of love. It's like they can't have love as they are, so they have to pretend to be someone else. That's the catfish mm-hmm. trope.
Yep. There's the vengeful sad fat person. Mm-hmm. Yep. Which I feel like the only example that I've seen personally is Insatiable, but she's not fat by the time that she's vengeful. But
I think Bridgerton kind of is that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Bridgerton is a good example of that, like Penelope Featherington sort of causing chaos.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I need more bitter fat people because like that was my coping mechanism. So I need representation of that.
More bitter representation. There's also channeling their sadness into exercise.
Or other positive, yeah.
Yep. Quote unquote positive things.
Right. Ideally, thing that makes them thinner and solves all their problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Brittany runs a marathon is the example here. Very yep. obviously.
Of course.
We'll talk probably more about that trope in the inspirational episode next week.
Yep. Perfect.
Yeah. So those are kind of the only contexts in which people have sympathy for fat characters because they're the only ones presented as sad, right? And if people couldn't empathize, right. they wouldn't be presented in that way.
Right.
And like if they're not sad, they're mocked or gawked at. But like mm-hmm. what I think is interesting is that something about these tropes like clearly resonates with people or they wouldn't keep being made. And it resonates with the writers too.
Absolutely. Yes.
Because I'm willing to bet a lot of these writers are not fat.
Yep, willing to bet.
And I actually have proof of two specific writers who have written sad fat characters based on their experiences as former fat people.
I have so much disdain for former fat people who suck ass like this. I really do.
So
I really do.
These God. Particular ones also were not very fat. First of all, okay, so example number one, I discovered this a couple years ago and my mind was blown. So Becca Brunstetter is this playwright who wrote this play called Fat Kids on Fire. In Fat Kids on Fire, which I think I've discussed on this podcast because it's one of the worst representations of fat people in my entire life, it follows this girl who's the thinnest girl at fat camp, which is based on Becca Brunstetter's real experience being the thinnest person at fat camp. And so basically she goes to fat camp and suddenly she's like the belle of the ball and all the guys want her, blah, blah, blah. And she makes this friend at fat camp who essentially is Martha Dunstock. And at the very end of the play, this girl's like hopelessly in love with the hot counselor and he like gives her one dance on the dance floor and then she collapses, has a heart attack and dies in the dance floor.
No.
That's the end of the play. Deadass. So The writer of this, who also, by the way, conceived a lot of the Kate storylines on This Is Us based out of her own personal experience, was the thinnest person at Fat Camp, has a lot of trauma from being a chubbier kid, but I have seen pictures on her personal blog, which she has really posted about this a lot on, and she was really never very fat. Like, she was kind of the fattest person in her community.
Okay.
Anyway, this is the person who wrote Kate on This Is Us and was specifically hired to write these storylines out of her personal experience. Example number two is, of course, Samuel D. Hunter, writer of The Whale himself.
Yep.
And I'm going to read you exactly what inspired The Whale. Samuel D. Hunter said in the same New Yorker article, "When I got to college, I just started falling deeper and deeper into depression. And this is not everybody, but for me personally, it manifested in pretty rapid weight gain throughout my 20s. He lost the weight over the next 10 years, he said, thanks to the support of his parents, a therapist, and his partner. Charlie's obesity grew out of Hunter's lived experience, but also out of worst-case speculation. What would happen to me if I hadn't turned that corner, if I didn't have the support system? I was looking at the way I was gaining weight back then and how rapidly it was happening. I was like, this could have been me." So that is why The Whale was written.
Sorry, you can't see me, but I'm like having a, I'm having a mental breakdown.
Yeah.
That is an insane, insane choice to make, to write about. Oh my God, to think you know anything about somebody with that experience.
Now, I'll be clear, I don't know how fat he actually got, but I don't think it was as fat as the character in The Whale, because
no,
it's a speculative thing, literally explicitly that.
Yes.
So, I just think it's interesting how these characters are being written out of people's worst fears and the childhood trauma of not even being that fat. And they're assuming what it's like to be fatter than that as an adult based on their being fatter in their youth, which I think is really interesting, because I think it's really important to note that I believe it is a fundamentally different experience to be fat as a child and fat as an adult, because when you're fat as a child, you don't know how to cope with it. And all you're getting, you're in school. People aren't polite yet. Kids don't have filters. You're probably getting bullied. You feel like you have to do all these things to protect yourself. By the time you're an adult, at minimum, you've honed those protective mechanisms.
Yes.
And, you know, best case scenario, you found a fat community. You're feeling better about yourself. You've healed your relationship with food and exercise, maybe, if you're lucky. You have been in the world long enough to see fat people living full lives. You've been in the world long enough to have had some experiences as a fat person that probably somebody told you could never have, like, for example, being happy at any time ever. So I think it's just a really fundamentally different thing for someone, even who has experience being classed as fat in their community or their context, to then write, like, make these assumptions about lifelong fat people as adults.
Yep.
Who are much fatter than them, by the way.
Always. Yes.
So anyway, that's just my hot take about how fat people don't write these characters. These are thin people's worst fears. That's what they are. They're not representation. They are nightmare.
It's interesting how we don't always write what we know, huh?
But we write what we fear, what we think we know.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. But that you can't assume you know the experience of a person in a body you have never had and will never have, because you were a little fatter than you are now, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's also like not taking the disability into account at all, which is not something that all fat people have experienced, and like not something that you necessarily have any idea about if you were just like a little chubby at one point.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about how these stories resolve, because the conflict is established. It's that this person is sad because they're fat. So there are a few resolutions we can have now.
One, death.
Literally see the whale.
Literally, yes. look up death in the dictionary. another one is weight loss. I feel like that's kind of a common one, especially for the characters, you know, in shows that like had a fat past, like Fat Schmidt, like Monica.
We can't be sad for those characters because we know their lives end out okay because they lose weight.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that's a really obvious one to people, where it's like, well, if you're sad about how you're treated because you're fat, stop being fat. It's in your control.
Yep.
Whereas a solution to, say, homophobia might be more nuanced.
Just don't be gay. Like, just stop.
No. Well,
Stop
that's different.
pursuing.
That's different because you're born with it. So
Are
it's
you?
not a
Anyway,
choice.
is it? Hold on. That's a conversation we can have at another time. However, I have thoughts. I have thoughts about that one.
Okay. I
Yeah,
mean,
I.
here's what I'll say. As a bi person, I feel like to an extent, I have the privilege of choosing what my sexuality is or appears to be. But that's like,
Yep.
yeah, again, another conversation.
You don't have control over what's inside you, but like you have control over what you
You have
do.
control over who's inside you.
That, yes.
Sorry.
That was way better. God, I love that. I think you should say that whole sentence like that.
Okay. You don't have control over what's inside you, but you do have control over who's inside you.
True.
That's going to be our beginning of the episode.
Yes, that's perfect.
So, another resolution of the sad fat person is really specific to romantic situations. And I think this is really important to note because so much of the tragedy of the sad fat person for women, specifically for everyone, but like especially for women, is that you'll never have romantic love because this
Yep.
is like obviously the thing sold to particularly women as the ultimate, the ultimate marker of like self-esteem and validation. Right. So the sad fat girl is often sad because she cannot have this ultimate marker of like femininity.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's a fucking dissertation that I need to write. So, anyway,
Yep.
so the solution to this, if it's not weight loss, is often settling. And it's often like finding a character of equivalent attractiveness. So I'm going to read this quote from an article on mamamia.com. It is interesting that almost always the happy ending involves the sad fat girl character settling, with the not so subtle implication that fat girls have to settle. Shrill actually tried to make a guy too embarrassed to introduce the main character to his housemates because of her size into a romantic lead. Happy endings for the sad fat girl often seem like the consolation prize. These characters are always forced to think outside of the box to find their happy ending. Interestingly, I think in the case of fat men, the happy ending is often that the girl has to settle for him.
Absolutely.
The example that I think of here is Samwell Tarly from Game of Thrones, who is deeply in love with the woman who ends up being his wife and mother of his children, and is constantly like rejected by her over and over and over again until one day she finally she sees him do something masculine enough that she's like, actually, I will be with you. And so,
Work.
yeah, it's kind of the opposite thing. Although I really like Sam from Game of Thrones, and I think he's a pretty good fat character overall. Like, I think it's interesting that like the solution for men is often being persistent enough to win the girl of their dreams, and the solution for women is
Right.
like not having such lofty dreams. But then I think this presents a dilemma as a fat person, and I literally just posted a TikTok about this, where it's like by viewing the mandate to date other fat people as demeaning, you're implicitly viewing fat people as less than. So
Absolutely.
I think there has to be some way around this because I think fat people are amazing and make great partners. I think they're hot and I think they're cool and I think they're wonderful a lot, not all, but like a lot of them.
Yep.
And I think they're like wonderful choices, but it is hard because when you're with another fat person, to the outside eye, they're like, well, that makes sense. You
Right.
know, I think when you're with another fat person, you end up sort of avoiding some of the judgment that you would get if you're with a thin person, but you also don't get the same clout.
Of
And you
course.
don't have that potential to like break that stereotype. So I feel like a lot of the more recent representations of fat women as like being empowered often couch that in like, and look how hot a guy she can get because she's attractive.
Absolutely.
But that fucks over the guys.
Yep.
So there's really no winning where we are right now. And that brings me to the next one, which is finding self-love through a man, which
Ooh.
is sort of adjacent to the settling trope. So, for example, like in Fat Girl, she just has to find an African guy who likes plus size girls. In Bring It On, she just has to go to the school where the black guys are. And so, oh my God, she's finally found her match and she can be confident now. Like,
right.
It's just the idea that you were just dating the wrong type of men, which are, of course, again, the type considered most conventionally attractive, white, of Western, course. Thin ones. So that's an interesting one, too, because to criticize that feels like I'm saying black people are less attractive or something, right?
Right.
But I definitely don't think that. It's just society does, and they're saying that. You know?
Right. I think that having any sort of like constraints being put on who you can and can't receive love from is something that kind of hurts to see.
Yes. That's,
you know,
really
what I
well
mean?
Said. Yeah.
So I honestly don't think it matters. I don't think it matters what kind of person it is, but if you're somehow saying you can only have a chance to be loved by this group of people, then it's like,
right.
Okay. Boo.
And even if there is true to the beauty standard being different in whatever community, it's still, there's still something demeaning about that. Because it's not across the board, and so it feels like a stereotype.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. And the final resolution of the sad fat person is that they, along with the audience, are taught a lesson. So if their sadness has made them mean at all, there's obviously that. Like, I think Penelope Featherington is like a good example, or any catfish where it's like, and she did something bad, you know? So that can be the resolution of, you should have loved yourself all along, or, you know, it's just the self-love of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, other people's opinions don't matter because it was actually all in your head all along. And so if people are mean to you, they actually won't be mean to you if you just love yourself first. And this is, I feel pretty. This is, isn't it romantic, right?
Right.
This is like that, the trope of being dropped on your head. So suddenly you think you're great. And then everyone else does too, of course, because it was all about you and your self-confidence and your beliefs and your individual work on yourself. And the rest of the world, they were just following your lead. So it's really not their fault at all that they treated you like shit for being fat.
Right. Because There are no societal issues at play here.
Right. And there are no confident fat people who still get treated like shit. Absolutely not.
Absolutely none. Yeah. That's
it's
not real.
It's hilarious that this is a trope, because look at any internet comment section of a fat person who is confident.
It is rancid.
So it's worse than if they were like, I'm so sorry and I'm so sad. At most,
no, literally.
When you do that, people lose weight. But if you are confident, they're going to, you get, you're destroying society, you fucking disgusting monster. So.
Right. People are going to die because of you. Like, literally shit like that. Like, you're killing people.
Yeah.
Like, shit, am I? Fuck. I didn't think I was.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Oh my God. Okay. So that's the sad fat person trope. Recently in my class had learned this thing that's really mind-blowing, which is about monstrosity and infrequent. And I think that applies here. And so I just want to sort of brief you on like what I've learned and how this can relate back to the fat thing. So this is when
I'm so excited.
This is when I go on a big monologue. Basically, this is all taken from an article that my professor wrote. It's like a book chapter of his book. Okay, the book is called Body Studies, the Basics, and the chapter is Monstrosity, Disability, and Infrequent. So I think a lot of this rhetoric can also apply to disabled people who are represented in that this same sort of pitiable way. And of course, every marginalized group has their own pity trope, right?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, this is all predicated on the fact that modern culture is very obsessed with the body. There's makeover shows, which he argues is like a policing of the body into like appropriate image. Which we talked about Foucault a lot, who has these theories of like the disciplined body. So it's all kind of in there. So there is this like definition of what is the appropriate body. And then on the other side of that, there is a quote, resurgence in the archaic spectacle of infrequent. This is the other side of pop culture, which is essentially like a different format for the freak show. So the bodies that are outside the norm used to be depicted as monsters, which either showed the power of God or like were warning of things to come. And this really famous disability scholar, Rosemary Garland Thompson, argued that all of the mythical monsters can be viewed as explanations for like unusual or different or disabled bodies that have startled people from different cultures.
Wow.
So then in the 17th century, teratology became a thing, which is like the study of, you know, monstrosity or birth defects or disability or whatever. So it's like the medicalization of the monster. It's literally like study of monsters. And this changed the monster from something that's like unfathomable and mythical to something that is, quote, almost human. And as a result, people were more able to identify with monstrous bodies. And this same other dichotomy, which was what the myth of monstrosity kind of narratives were predicated on, was like broken down. So then the bodies of, quote, monstrous people were started to be exhibited by like in like medical shows for educational purposes. And this like is sort of the precursor to the freak show. The thing is that monsters are still popular in entertainment. According to Garland Thompson, it's because they function as magnets to which culture secures its anxieties, questions, and needs at any given moment. So it's like monster has no definitive meaning. It's just a sponge that can absorb the anxieties of the time.
Yes. Yeah.
So people are able to project their anxieties onto this mythical like monster body. And one of the examples they use about this is actually fatness, which is interesting. Yeah. And so according to another scholar on monstrosity, Margaret Childrick, these monsters, which are the most like compelling to us, are the ones where we also recognize an element of ourselves. So they inspire a sense of difference, but also similarity. And that's why in monster movies, there's usually a sequence where the heroine exchanges a gaze with the monster. And then that's like the acknowledgement that there's a sense of mutual recognition between the human self and the monstrous other. And she says the monster in this respect is often a symbol for the dark emotions which we cannot accept about ourselves, such as lust or rage. And so this, like, if you watch a monster movie, there's like a lot of mirror symbology often. And this is also true of fat people, tragic fat people. Like, it's always like she's looking in the mirror and she's so sad and she wishes she could be different. Like, we talked about this in Precious. There's a really telling clip where she sees herself in the mirror and she's a thin white girl.
That's fascinating. I'm going to watch a bunch of horror movies now.
Please do, because I don't like them. So you can do the case study part of this.
Work.
Anyway, in the 19th century, there was then this like commercialization of monsters in these like low culture freak shows, which if you've seen The Greatest Showman, you know the guy, P.T. Barnum, who like kind of started this in 1850. And that like turned the unusual bodies into freaks, which according to David Heavey is infreakment. So that's the argument that like the body might be different, strange, even unusual, but it is the mechanism of representation which renders this body a freak. So the example that my professor used in this book chapter is actually the world's fattest lady, and that like, yeah, she's a very fat lady, but she was called and billed the fattest, right? Like,
of course.
And she was shown in context that emphasized her size, like the set would be smaller to make her look bigger and stuff like
that.
Yes. So then another scholar called Robert Bogden devised these like two modes of freak representation. So he defined two different modes. The first is exoticization, which is like kind of underpinned by eroticism. And it's like the gawking and the like, can you believe how fat that lady is kind of vibes. But then the example they use with the fat lady, which I think I've talked about on here before, is there's this picture where she's lifting up her skirt and showing off her ankle, which like at the time was very, very taboo. So it was probably the only time people were getting to see this kind of like this part of the body was in this lady that was a freak. And they were like, damn, you know?
Right.
So there's like an exoticization of that and an eroticization, or it's kind of similar to like racial like exoticism and how that's like fetishized. The other example they use is the snake charmer.
That reminds me of Sarah Bartman.
Yes. That's like everything about this. anyway, okay. So then the second mode, which is why I wanted to talk about this on this episode and not next week, is the aggrandized mode. So in this mode, the performing talent of the freak is emphasized. So when you watch the freak perform or like have a skill, or like maybe the fat lady sings really well, or the snake charmer charms snakes, or like, you know what I mean? Like whoever this person is, oh my God, they played the violin even though they have like no feet, like whatever, you know?
Right.
Then you go, wow, that's so amazing. They've overcome so much to be able to make such beautiful art, even though they're so ugly and disgusting. Like,
yep.
So,
oh my God.
It's like partly the idea that like there has to be a compensation for the way they look, or like for their disability or their size. Mm. But then there's also the politics of pity of it all, where it makes us feel more okay about gawking at them because they have this other thing. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So the way that this lives on is often in our talent shows. So the example given here is Susan Boyle, who I'm sure you guys remember back in the day. God. She went on America's Got Talent. And everyone was like, who is this gross old fat lady? And then she opened her mouth. She has a glorious angel voice. And everyone's like, wow, maybe we were wrong to judge.
Wow.
The thing that enables her to be tragic and not just comic is her serious and genuine skill at something.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to put this in here. Because in order for somebody to be sad to us, we have to take them seriously in some respect. We have Absolutely. To recognize some aspect of their humanity, but not really the full aspect of their humanity, you know?
Certainly not.
So here's a quote about this, of why the freak body is so compelling to us. One of the pleasures of watching the representation of the freak body is that arguably it makes the spectators feel better about themselves. In other words, the freak body can function as a convenient defining other. Representations of freak bodies are ways of making the majority feel more secure by juxtaposing their well-managed, appropriate bodies against the defining other of the freak body.
Mm.
Yeah. So this is all related to the politics of pity, which is a concept by the German scholar Hannah Arendt, I don't know, but A-R-E-N-D-T. She gets talked about in my classes all the time, and I still don't know how to pronounce her name, even though I've heard like many professors say it out loud. Slay. So the politics of pity is something that she actually wrote about the French Revolution, interestingly enough.
Wow.
And when she wrote about this, she made the distinction between those who suffer and those who do not. And she wrote that seeing and looking are considered as different concepts because the sufferer and the observer are like physically distant.
Mm.
So you're seeing the spectacle of suffering. The unfortunate people who are observed by those who do not share their suffering do not experience it directly and therefore may be regarded as fortunate. Mm. So then in media, it's like audiences are observers of the misery of the unfortunate, but within a distance, which is not just geographical, but also emotional. And I feel like this is like exactly what is the deal with the tragic fat person. Like it
Absolutely.
Is a convenient defining other. So you watch the people on My 600-pound Life and you say, well, at least I'm not as big as them. And
mm-hmm.
it's a much more explicit kind of way, I think, than the comedy. Where it's mm-hmm. like, not only are you pointing and laughing at them, now you're like, and I can feel good about myself for this. But
Absolutely.
There's still this like undercover reassurance.
I love this quote. I love this quote that you wrote down from Guy.
Yes.
Branum?
Yes. I'm literally Guy Branum's biggest fan and he does follow me on Twitter. Thank you.
Wow. It's a great quote.
It's from the same New Yorker Whale article. Do you want to read it?
Yeah. I think it is a weird attempt to use the existence of someone like me to make people who aren't like me feel better about how they're not like me.
Yes.
It is weird.
It is weird. And that's why it's made by thin people, because no fat person would make this.
Absolutely.
It's not a true representation. And a lot of people defend the whale by saying that it is.
No, so. It's literally not. I'm sorry. If you're wearing a fat suit, it's not representation. Bye.
Yeah. And if it's written by a thin person, it's not representation. That's my hot take.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that the way in which this trope assumes a thin spectator is by separating fat people from their fatness. So you separate person from fat, right? It's like this sort of person first language thing where it's like people with obesity. So it's like the obesity is over here and that's what we're watching and we're laughing at or we're mocking or we're pitying on screen. You are separate from that. So you are part of a thin audience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you have a thin soul. We all do.
Oh my God, yeah, exactly. Oh boy. So yeah, the commonality with this and the comedy trope is the assumption that no fat people are in the audience. And we are going to get to the next trope next week to talk about the inspirational and whether that is the same or not.
Yeah, I feel like there are definitely sad and inspirational intertwine quite often, I think.
Much to discuss.
For fat tropes.
Okay, we got to make a Google Doc so we can
Write
up a next week's script. All right, well, we're going to talk about that after we sign off. But for now, thank you so much for listening. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of More Than Tracy Turnblad.
If you liked it, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
For more content, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/morethantracyt.
Follow us on social media at More Than Tracy T on everything. I'm Abby.
I'm Luce. And we are More Than Tracy Turnblad.